Hello and welcome back. We've now traced the Greeks and the Romans interacting with one another over a period of about 500 years, initially through commercial contacts, then through political, military, religious exchanges of various sorts. It's time to investigate what impact this all had in their perceptions of one another. What, in plain language, did the Greeks and the Romans think about each other? Most of our evidence comes from the Roman side. We know relatively little about what the Greeks thought about the Romans. That doesn't mean, of course, that they didn't vent just as much, but if they did it in writing, the writing just hasn't survived. So we're going to be concentrating on the Roman view of the Greeks, though I'll have something to say about the Greek view of the Romans at the end. The Romans manifest essentially two contradictory tendencies: Philhellenism, the love of Greeks and all things Greek, and Hellenophobia, the detestation of Greeks and all things Greek. They're contradictory tendencies, but they're certainly not mutually exclusive. Even in the case of a single Roman citizen, feelings towards Greeks are likely to have been, well, conflicted, to say the least. And the same was true of responses to the phenomenon that we call Hellenism as well. As Eric Gruen writes, individual Romans might savour philosophy, collect statues and painting, and master the Greek tongue, but most shrank from a close identification with Hellenism. Incidentally, Philhellenism, the love of all things Greek, was a major feature of the Romantic movement. One of the greatest romantics and one of the greatest Philhellenes was the English poet Lord Byron, who went out to fight in the Greek War of Independence and who died of malaria in 1824, aged 36, sadly without even reaching the front line. What undoubtedly skewed the relationship between the two peoples was the fact that most Romans and Greeks encountered one another in the capacity of master or mistress and slave. This was because, A, by the first century BC, Rome had conquered the majority of the Greek-speaking world, and B, the Greeks were a highly skilled, intelligent and educated people who comprised the most sought-after slaves. As we've seen, there was a huge human as well as artistic cost to the Roman conquest of Greece. The Romans devastated the Greek economy, despoiled Greece of many of its art treasures, and uprooted tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Greeks, while massacring many thousands more. Yet the fact remains that the Greeks and Romans had an enduring relationship with one another that has virtually no parallel in the whole of history. Even though they had very different roots, spoke different languages, did not see the world alike, and certainly didn't share the same political interests, they were indubitably joined at the hip. Let me state categorically at the beginning of this lecture that both the Greeks and the Romans were deeply prejudiced. And it goes without saying that there was no legislation or any other kind of safeguard to protect anyone from being the victim of a racist slur or, for that matter, a racist-inspired attack. Racism, in short, was okay. More than that, it was essential to one's sense of identity, defining oneself in opposition to an inferior other. That's how the Greeks saw themselves in relation to all barbarians, including the Romans, and that's how the Romans, in the earlier period at least, saw themselves in relation to all non-Romans, including the Greeks. There are all sorts of ways in which we can try to encapsulate the differences between the two cultures, and educated people have been coming up with interesting formulations ever since antiquity. Cato the Elder, dates 234 to 149 BC, was of the opinion that, I quote, "Greeks speak with their tongues, Romans with their hearts." What he meant was that Greeks were facile and untrustworthy, whereas Romans were sincere and straightforward. We'll have more to say about Cato a bit later. He's a central figure in our understanding of the Roman response towards Hellenism. Two centuries later, Quintilian, a teacher and the author of a book on rhetoric, wrote, Whereas the Greeks excelled in teaching, the Romans excelled in action. A more important charge. That's a rather less biased description, but it's biased nonetheless. Just as an aside, there's no evidence to indicate that the Romans ever modified their political dealings with the Greeks as a result of Hellenism's impact upon their culture, although they were, at least down to 190 BC, somewhat sympathetic towards the Greeks. Interestingly, even those Romans who were strongly pro or anti-Greek culture did not carry culture into politics. Cato, for instance, who was extremely hostile to Hellenism, voted against punishing Rhodes after the Third Macedonian War, while Aemilius Paulus, the younger contemporary and one of the great Philhellenes of the age, advocated for taking extreme measures against Epirus. So, where did the antithetical tendencies that we're examining in this lecture have their roots? Though Hellenism, notably in the sphere of religion, was already in evidence from the early 5th century BC onwards, it began to assume a much more encompassing character from the end of the 3rd century BC onwards. A definitive moment was in 211 BC, when the Roman general Marcus Claudius Marcellus sacked the Greek city of Syracuse in Sicily and shipped many of its art treasures back to Rome. This too, as we saw earlier, was the period when all distinction between Roman and Greek gods was officially annulled. The family most closely associated with Philhellenism in this period is that of the Scipios, Publius Cornelius Scipio Africanus and his adopted grandson, Publius Cornelius Scipio Aemilianus Africanus. The elder Scipio was granted the cognomen or surname Africanus because it was he who had defeated Hannibal at the Battle of Zama in 202 BC. Scipio Africanus acquired his taste for Hellenism while residing in Sicily before his invasion of North Africa, when he visited the Greek palaestra, or wrestling school, and wore Greek clothes. There's further evidence of his Hellenization in the fact that he consciously modelled himself on Alexander the Great, and in the fact that he encouraged Ennius, the first Latin poet, to write an epic account of Roman history in hexameter verse, for Ennius was himself deeply inspired by Greek epic. Scipio Africanus's adopted grandson, Scipio Aemilianus, seems to have been an even more gung-ho advocate of Greek culture, and I'll be talking about him in a moment. The Scipios seem to have been unequivocal in their support of Hellenism. A much more complicated attitude was represented by Cato the Elder. It was Cato's belief that contact with Greek culture was undermining Roman hardihood. Greek literature, Greek physicians, the Greek practice of being naked in the gymnasium, you name it, Cato detested it all. Cato even refused to allow his son to be taught by a Greek, because he said it was demeaning to be reprimanded by a slave or for him to have his ears pulled if he was slow in learning. In a letter to his son, he called the Greeks a vile race that couldn't be taught anything. And yet, Cato was himself deeply influenced by and even enamored of Hellenism, as we shall see when we talk about his literary output. He was a very conflicted figure. Some scholars see Cato as the leader of an anti-Hellenic movement, but it's highly doubtful whether any such thing actually existed. The Hellenophobes, like the Philhellenes, were not a party as such, but simply what I've already called a tendency, and there were conflicts, as I've suggested, within the same person. Next question. How did Roman prejudice against the Greeks most obviously manifest itself? Well, basically, by claiming that they exhibited a number of vices which proved that the Greeks were morally inferior. To begin with, the Greeks were extremely fickle. Second, they were mendacious. They were crafty and conniving, too clever by half, and they weren't to be trusted. Third, they were thoroughly two-faced. They pretended to be your friends, but they were only after their own self-interest. And they really couldn't care about you at all. As a result, they managed to do very well for themselves financially, while decent, hard-working Romans had to scrimp and save. And fourth, they were morally depraved. That at least, or something like it, is the stereotype of the Greeks that Romans, even educated Romans it seems, held. Incidentally, the Greeks weren't the only people who were the butt of prejudice. John Ballston, in a study entitled Romans and Aliens, provides a list of all the racial slurs that the Romans levelled at a host of different peoples, including the Arabs, the Carians, the Cappadocians, the Egyptians, the Gauls, the Germans, the Jews, the Paphlagonians, the Phrygians and the Syrians, etc., whom they variously castigated as dishonest, stupid, fickle, drunken, illiterate, rascally and so forth. So we could say that the Romans liberally bestowed their ethnic prejudice upon pretty well all the peoples whom they encountered and had dealings with. I now want to examine certain key statements from Plautus, Cicero, Virgil, and Juvenal that lend support to the stereotype I've just painted. The statements are important precisely because they're drawn from such a disparate set of authors writing in different genres over such a wide span of time. First, the comic playwright Plautus. In his play Monstellaria, the title means something like a play about monstra or ghosts. Plautus was writing at the end of the 3rd and beginning of the 2nd century BC. He has one of his characters say, I quote, "Now, as long as you want, and as long as you can, drink up, ruin yourself, corrupt the best and wealthiest young men, get sloshed night and day, behave like Greeks, buy and sell girls, feed the parasites, have a great banquet." Well, the word I've translated as behave like Greeks is pergreikor, and it means literally to be a thorough Greek. It really applies to the entire list of activities which he cites, since these are regarded as characteristic of Greek decadence. Well, this of course is a statement in a comedy, but I think we can be fairly certain that Plautus's audience would have given it a rousing cheer, confirming as it did their own prejudices against the Greeks. Second, Cicero, who lived about 150 years later than Plautus and who was as deeply Hellenized as any Roman. In a letter to his brother Quintus, in which he is giving him advice about how to conduct himself as a governor in a Greek province, Cicero warns him not to get too close to the Greeks, except those who are worthy of their great ancestors. Why? Because, I quote, "they're deceitful, untrustworthy, servile, and given to obsequiousness. Still," Cicero goes on to say, "you have to keep on good terms with them because they're so skilled at doing things behind your back." Third, Virgil, who lived a generation later than Cicero. In Book 3 of the Aeneid, Aeneas describes how the tricky Greeks succeeded in taking Troy by the device of the wooden horse. The horse had been left on the shore outside the city, filled with Greek soldiers. While the Trojans were deliberating what to do about it, whether to destroy it as a booby trap, or whether to bring it inside their walls as a kind of talisman, they encounter a Greek named Sinon on the shore. Sinon tells the Trojans that his comrades have given up hope of capturing the city and are sailing back home. He claims to have escaped after Ulysses, another Greek who had a reputation among the Romans for mendacity and trickiness, had selected him as a human sacrifice to be offered up to the gods in return for a safe passage home. In reality, the Greek fleet lies hidden off the island of Tenedos, just off the Turkish shore, and Sinon is what we would call today a double agent, planted there to deceive the Trojans. Sinon spins a hugely plausible tale about how his feud with Ulysses began. What makes him particularly despicable is the way in which he plays upon the heartstrings of the thoroughly decent Trojan audience. After telling his story, he says, "I have no more hope of seeing my country awe of seeing my little sons or my father, who I love so much. The Greeks will exact revenge upon them because of my escape and make them pay with their lives because of what I've done. He then goes on, and this is where Virgil pulls out all the stops in painting Sinon as the most despicable wretch alive. Yet I beg you by the gods, by the high powers that bear witness to truth, by faith, if anywhere upon this earth she still exists inviolate, I beg you to have compassion on so terrible an ordeal and to take pity on one who has too much to bear. Of course, the kind-hearted Trojans, the ancestors of the kind-hearted Romans, remember, believe him. They receive the wooden horse into their city. The Greeks climb down out of the horse's belly while the good people of Troy are sleeping in their beds, and a massacre takes place. That's where the infamous line, "Beware of Greeks bearing gifts," Timeo, Danaos et dona ferentes, literally, "I fear the Greeks even when they're bearing gifts," comes from, which, thanks to Virgil's prejudicial image of the Greeks, has entered into our culture as a quintessential expression of mistrust. Virgil could hardly have painted a more inflammatory portrait of Greek duplicity. And all this narrative is told by Aeneas in person. Aeneas, the father of the Roman race. Aeneas, the embodiment of the Roman virtue of pietas. And Aeneas precedes his narrative with these telling words. "Now hear how the Greeks tricked us. Learn from one instance of the wickedness of every Greek." Isn't that exactly how racism starts? Well, I've gone on about this passage because Virgil was in so many other ways a model of Roman decency, sensitivity, and sensibility. We shouldn't, of course, assume that he intended to incite racism, but he was certainly playing into the racist mindset of his audience. After all, he was writing Rome's national epic. Fourth, Juvenal, a satirist of the 2nd century AD, who in his third satire puts a venomous tirade into the mouth of a down-at-heels Roman called Umbricius. Umbricius explains to the narrator of the poem that he is so sickened by life in the big city that he has decided to move to Cumae in the Bay of Naples. He says, "And now I'm going to speak about the race that is so popular with the rich and which I run away from above all others, and I'm not going to pull any punches. I can't abide a Greek Rome, my fellow Romans." That's quite an assertion, by the way, a Greek Rome. It reminds us just how large was the Greek-speaking population of Rome, a topic we'll be considering in the next lecture. Umbricius continues, "What do you think that fellow over there is? He's brought every skill you could want with him. He's a schoolteacher, an orator, a geometrician, a painter, a master of wrestling, an augur, a rope dancer, a physician, an astrologer. He knows it all. Your starving Greekling," Graeculus is the word used there, and Graeculus is a term of abuse, little Greek. "If you tell him to go to hell, he'll go there. If you laugh, your Greek will spit his sides with laughter. If he sees his friend weeping, he weeps in turn, but without feeling any emotion. He's ready at any moment of the day or night to borrow another man's expression, to throw up his hands and applaud if he gives a good belch or if he urinates accurately into a chamber pot." Juvenal is writing well over a century later than Virgil, which suggests that the prejudice against Greeks was alive and well. Again, we should, however, be cautious, perhaps even more so in his case. He may well be tapping into a widely held prejudice purely for literary or artistic effect. We certainly should not facilely assume that Umbricius is Juvenal's mouthpiece. He seems to be mocking him in part. There's certainly an irony in his wanting to retire to Cumae, which was a city where Greek culture was very much to the fore. Even so, Umbricius represents a Roman viewpoint that was undoubtedly familiar to Juvenal, even if it seemed somewhat laughable. Everything I've said so far sounds pretty bleak. Is there nothing to redeem the quite negative picture I've drawn so far? Well, not much, though that may just be that it hasn't survived in our sources. There is, however, one very moving testimony to a deep and abiding friendship between a Greek and a Roman. It's provided by Polybius, who in his histories gives an account of the development of his relationship with the younger Scipio. Polybius alleges that they became so close to one another that the fame of their relationship spread even beyond Italy and Greece, he says. It was, he goes on to say, based on a type of mutual affection, I quote, that could only be compared to that of a father and a son or of relatives sharing the same blood. It was due to Scipio and to Aemilius Paulus, whom we mentioned earlier, the destroyer of Epirus, by the way, that Polybius, one of the 1,000 Achaeans who were taken hostage by the Romans in 167, was permitted to live in Rome rather than in one of the towns of Italy, as was the fate of the others. So he had reason to be grateful to Scipio, and reason, too, to celebrate their relationship. But that doesn't mean that he wasn't sincere. Cato the Elder, by the way, when the topic of freeing the Achaeans came up in the Senate, derisively asked, haven't we got anything better to do with our time than to debate whether some Greek geriatrics should be buried by Roman undertakers here in Italy or by Greek undertakers back in Greece? All educated Romans were, of course, fully aware that although the Greek world had succumbed politically to Rome, it was the Greeks who, in all things cultural, firmly had the upper hand. In later lectures, we're going to be tracing the impact of Hellenism in detail, because there was virtually no branch of learning or artistic or literary expression, no skill that the Romans practiced, that did not owe an enormous debt to the Greeks. As Cicero put it, for indeed, it was not a little stream that flowed from Greece to Rome, but a mighty river of culture and learning. Or as the Augustan poet Horace wrote, most memorably, Greece, the captive, made her savage victor captive and brought the arts into rustic Latium. Graecia capta ferum victorim capit, et artis intulit agresti Latio. In just about everything they aspired to achieve, the Greeks had been there, done that long before the Romans got going in the Mediterranean. Just to give a couple of examples, Roman generals were always looking over their shoulder at Alexander the Great. I've already mentioned Scipio Africanus modelling himself on Alexander the Great. Similarly, Gnaeus Pompeius, Pompey as we usually call him, also styled himself the Great and even aped Alexander's characteristic tousled hairstyle. His arch rival, Julius Caesar, is reported to have burst into tears while reading a history of Alexander. And when asked by his friends what was the matter, he replied, I've just been thinking that at my age, Alexander had made himself king over many peoples, whereas I've done practically nothing. That statement, for me, epitomizes the Roman sense of inferiority in regard to Greek achievement. It's actually very moving. And when Cicero began to attack Mark Antony in a series of vituperative speeches after Caesar's death, he entitled them the Philippics, after the speeches that the great Athenian orator Demosthenes had delivered against Philip II of Macedon. The implication was that after the assassination of Caesar, Mark Antony was craftily seeking to achieve power by devious means, just as Philip had done when he sought to achieve mastery over the Greek city-states. The title Philippics was a joke of sorts, but the fact that Cicero was also comparing himself to the greatest orator of all time would not have been lost on educated Romans who knew the basics of Greek history. So how did the Romans manage to live with themselves, knowing they were culturally inferior? In the first instance, they claimed that all the arts that the Greeks excelled in weren't worth a hill of beans compared with the one art that they, the Romans, did supremely well, which was to bring political stability and good government to the peoples who lived under them. No one put this more succinctly than Virgil, who in Aeneid Book 6 puts the following prophecy into the mouth of Aeneas's father Anchises. I have no doubt that others, he means the Greeks, We'll mould in more flowing style the breathing bronze, or shape lifelike portraits out of marble, or plead more effectively in the courts, or mark out with an astronomer's staff the paths of the heavens and describe the risings of the stars. Make it your business, Roman, to rule peoples. This will be your art, and to enforce the way of peace, which is to spare those who are subjugated, and to render unwarlike the proud. It's a rather arrogant statement of self-definition, but it's also, as well, very moving. And clearly the point that Anchises is making is that what others can do is pretty lightweight compared with being the world's policeman. The second way the Romans got round the thorny subject of cultural indebtedness and inferiority was by claiming to be morally superior to the Greeks. The Greeks, they thought, indulged in all sorts of beastly and forbidden practices. They danced, they ate, and they drank to excess. They were moral weather vanes, and they were sexually incontinent. It's a miracle they didn't all go blind. The view of the Greeks as a thoroughly depraved and degenerate people was confirmed from the Roman point of view by the simple fact that Rome had supplanted Greece as top nation. Greece had become subject to Rome, so the argument ran, because earlier Greeks had showed themselves to be incompetent in running their own affairs. It was just deserts, in other words. Finally, let's try to address the question, what did the Greeks in general think about the Romans? We've already talked about Polybius, but he was anything but representative. Most of the peoples whom the Romans conquered probably saw some benefit in adapting their customs, etc., to those of the conqueror, in terms of the status they received, influence among the Romans, money and self-esteem. The Greeks, however, were the exception. They made little accommodation to Roman culture and were arguably one of the least Romanized of all the people under Roman domination. By the same token, they were also the people least prepared to subscribe to the notion that their conquerors were superior to them in any way whatever. That's because they felt very secure in the achievements of their culture and in its antiquity. The orator Isocrates, 436 to 338, very long-lived person, had declared that, I quote, "Athens has brought it to pass that the name of Greek should no longer be thought of as a matter of race, but a matter of intelligence." Not all Greeks were Athenians, of course, but centuries later, most Greeks, even after being comprehensively beaten by the Romans, probably still agreed with him. Part of the reason for the Greek attitude was the fact mentioned earlier that from a Greek perspective, all non-Greeks were barbarians. Even Macedonians like Alexander the Great had had a hard time justifying to other Greeks that they weren't semi-barbarian. Pliny, quoting the elder Cato, says, "The Greeks call us barbarians, and they stereotype us more foully than they do any other people by calling us Oppiki." Oppiki was the name of an Oscan tribe that the Greeks living in Campania had encountered at much the same time when they first came into contact with the Romans. The Greeks evidently thought the Oppiki were pretty stupid and assigned the name to the Romans, not realizing, or more likely simply ignoring the fact, that the Romans weren't actually related to the Oppiki. Incidentally, it's interesting to speculate that if the Greeks had ended up dominating the Romans, the latter might have acquired the name Oppiki, just as the Romans ended up calling the Greeks after an insignificant tribe in Epirus called Graeci. One last point. A Greek historian called Dionysius of Halicarnassus, writing at the time of Augustus's rise to power, makes a point of denying that the Romans were barbarians and, in fact, traces their origins to Arcadia in the Peloponnese to prove that they were Greeks. How very magnanimous of him. What we can deduce from this, however, is that in the late 1st century BC, when Dionysius was writing, there were still Greeks calling the Romans barbarians, or else he wouldn't have sought to correct the error. To conclude, we've discussed a broad body of evidence in this lecture to support the claim that relations between the two peoples on the personal level are likely to have been, well, strained at best. That evidence has extended from the late 3rd century, early 2nd century BC to the 1st century AD. At the same time, we have noted that responses to Hellenism are likely to have been extremely complicated. In the next lecture, we're going to look at how the Latin and Greek languages fared in competition with one another and how they too played a part in shaping the relationship between the two peoples. As in the case of culture, so in the case of language, Greek, though it did not conquer Latin in Horace's image, yet it fully held its own.